We talked about last week how to see the Buddha and how the fact that Shakyamuni Buddha is not dead. Now, I would like you to, since what I am setting for next week is just simply to go through the parts of the Denkoroku that happen to be in Zen's Eternal Life, I'd like to go through some pieces to show you how to read this particular book. Each chapter is divided into several parts. The first part is the anecdote that is normally handed down through the centuries concerning each of the patriarchs. In the case of chapter 2, for example, then Sesson Shakyamuni, the most respectable person in this whole world, took a flower and winked. Marka Kishore smiled. Shakyamuni said that the truth was within him and transmitted Marka Kishore. Now you'll see a little piece like that set apart at the beginning of each chapter. That is the introduction and anecdote concerning how the truth was recognized in each of the ancestors or each of the people who had Kensho in our particular line and was transmitted down to the present day. Thereafter, there follows a short historical note. Now, you have to remember that Keizan Zenji, who wrote these short historical notes, and I say historical in quotes, was anything but a historian. However, he was an incredibly good imaginative writer. And apparently he was not worried, as some historians are, by historical accuracy, but preferred instead... yes, spiritually, he's absolutely accurate spiritually, but historically, don't ever quote him, because the odds are you'll be wrong. In some cases, he is right, but mostly he is wrong historically, so do not think of this as a historical work. He gives rough periods of time. He definitely says who met who, so from chronologically, he's accurate. But with regard to what happened actually in their lifetimes, he is not to be regarded as accurate. Now, having considered that, about halfway through each chapter, he starts talking about how the transmission took place. Now, if you listen to this with your just the ordinary thinking mind, you will not understand it. You have to listen to it in this place within, this place in the Hara, and hear what is going on, remembering what I said last week, that Shakyamuni Buddha is born out of the old Shakyamuni Buddha, the old Gotama. The original, his original name was Gotama, and he became Shakyamuni the Buddha. So the second stage of him is a rebirth out of the first stage of him. And each of these stories explains how the rebirth took place in each of the ancestors down the ages. Now, if you look at the end of the last chapter, it says that although Shakyamuni Buddha is enlightened, always he had the face and figure of an old monk. So do not consider that a monk is going to be something specific, special, different to look at. If you are worrying about external things, you will always be arguing, as I pointed out last week, what is a monk? This person is this way, this person is a different way, one is tall, one is short, one I like, one I don't like. You have to get beyond the opposites to this exquisite place where the cosmic Buddha exists in every single one. And when you do that, yes, Shakyamuni Buddha will always have the face and figure of Shakyamuni Buddha, an old monk. And Marga Kishore will always have the face and figure of Marga Kishore. As it says in here, he was so untidy and so coarse that people wondered what he was. They didn't wonder who he was, they wondered what he was. There is a substantial difference. So, roughly halfway through each, you get the explanation of the little story at the beginning. The so-called taking of a flower has come down to this time, being transmitted from one ancestor to another. Those who are not transmitted cannot understand it, nor can the teachers of scriptures and logic. Those who are not transmitted, those who have not found this exquisite place within themselves where the opposites no longer exist. Transmission nowadays in the Soto school of Buddhism, and in Rinzai also, I suspect, implies that a person has become serious enough to be a priest, and Kensho has taken the place of what used to be called transmission. In Keizan's book, however, the word transmitted always implies having had a full-scale Kensho. So, those who have not had a Kensho cannot understand this, nor can the teachers of scriptures and logic, because they're in their heads. There's a mistake here, the new, know, and will know. It is just, I know well, they have no understanding that is real. As this is so, this is not the koan at the Ryozen meeting, but the one at the Tashi Tower. It is wrong to say that this is anything else. When Buddhism was transmitted for the first time, there was the ceremony described above, the ceremony of taking a flower. You should not mistake for a ceremony concerning taking a flower. It is a recognition within, from one person to another. Now, you have heard me speak on a number of occasions that when an actual Kensho takes place, there is, as it were, this movement of water I've spoken of. And in one of the scriptures, it says, a rain of Dharma comes as nectar down. It has been described as nectar, as honey, as water. There's a number of things of this description, always liquid. Now, when two people are transmitted in the way in which Keizan is speaking of here, when it is an actual Kensho, the wheel, as it is called, the wheel of the law, turns in both, and the wheel of the disciple turns the wheel in the master, and the wheel in the master turns the wheel in the disciple, so that they both simultaneously experience the water of the Spirit flowing through them, and they are no longer two separate individuals, but one being which is beyond emptiness. And this is why one is within this exquisite place within oneself, this exquisite place which lies beyond good and evil and all the other opposites of which one can think. And this is what is being spoken of in this particular book. What happened, what it was that triggered this oneness between master and disciple, which proved that the disciple had truly found this exquisite place and was therefore fit to actually teach, because you can't teach what you don't know. You can't teach that this thing exists until you found it. And when you found it, you know quite well if somebody else has found it, because he can find it in you just as much as you can find it in him. And that is why it is such an advantage if a master has more than one disciple who does this, because if ever the wheel turns only a tiny amount and the master is not completely sure whether it has turned or whether he imagined it, he can always get two or three others of those who've had it happen and say, all right, would you check this for me? You see, the wheel turning is the wheel turning. It's the same as a little pregnant is pregnant. Even if it only moves half a turn, it's still turned. If it moves a lot, there's no problem. But every now and then you get someone in whom it doesn't turn too much first go. And what are you going to say? It didn't turn. So then you have to get the assistance of others who have had it happen. And therefore it is impossible to ever mistake a true cantrell, because it turns the wheel in everyone else who has ever had it. In other words, God recognizes God, or Buddha recognizes Buddha, and Buddha bows to Buddha, as in the recognition ceremony of the last part of Jukai, the true recognition. But it is more than recognition in one sense. It is one flowing into the other, and they are all one true spirit. And it is the finding of this one true spirit that also gives the certainty. And I'm going to talk a lot more about that today. So, as Kazam points out, leave the taking of a flower as it is. Don't get worried about the taking of a flower. Don't get worried about the externals. There is no difference between your wink and Shakyamuni's, and there is no difference between your talking and smiling and Marika Shaw's talking and smiling. But if you do not understand what is really going on underneath all of this, all you are going to do is be stuck with seeing a flower and a wink. Do not get caught up in the externals. Look and find this exquisite place within. Did you know that when Shakyamuni raised his brow and winked, he had disappeared? Further, did you know that when Marika Shaw smiled, he had been enlightened? I puzzled and argued with Goho Zenji and the imperial teacher over what tense to put the verbs in this thing. And we ended up coming up with something which said was, is, and will be on almost every occasion. And this should be so here. Was, is, and will be enlightened. Was, is, and did disappear. Shakyamuni Buddha, as we know him, was not there. Marika Shaw had found that enlightened place that had been with him eternally. Neither of them were there as we know it, because both of them had disappeared. The ego, the human, that which we call this psychophysical thing had nothing to do with it. And yet it was the aegis by which this place was found, because it was through the aegis of meditation that it was found. There is nothing to be given. By taking a flower, Shakyamuni showed that the truth was, is, and will be internal. And by smiling, he pointed out that it was, is, and will be endless. In other words, he recognized what was in Marika Shaw. Because of this, in seeing each other face to face, the life of the truth has come down from master to disciple to this time. In seeing each other face to face is, that's a slightly Taoist way of saying it. Seeing recognition within the eyes. But in actual fact, it is in knowing each other, in flowing into each other within the actual hara, becoming one with that which is, and knowing that this is the eternal, is the real way in which it would be better to write it. It's very slightly Taoist to say through the eyes. So, having perfect wisdom without worldly knowledge and cutting off his consciousness, Marika Shaw entered Mount Keisoku, where he was, is, and will be waiting for Miroku. Therefore, Marika Shaw is not dead. Now, this is the most important piece of this chapter with regard to us. Having perfect wisdom without worldly knowledge, i.e., not worrying about erudition, not thinking about things deliberately, and cutting off deliberate thought. Having natural thought without deliberate thought, this may read. Therefore, having natural thought without deliberate thought. Marka Kishore entered Mount Keisoku. Another name for the Hara is Mount Keisoku. He entered into his true home, where he is waiting for Miroku. Miroku is the Buddha that is to come. You, me, everybody in this room, everybody throughout the world. Within that place, Marka Kishore is not dead. You are not dead. No one who has ever lived is dead. There they wait eternally in joy for every other living thing. Therefore, Marka Kishore entered into Mount Keisoku and does not die, for there he waits for Miroku. But, as it points out later on, if you can really understand and practice the truth, i.e., cause the wheel to circle. If you can practice the truth, not only Marka Kishore is eternal, but Shakyamuni Buddha is eternal also. Therefore, the truth which was, is, and will be transmitted from the far past, when no one was, is, and will be born, is spreading constantly all over the past and the future. Therefore, you and Shakyamuni Buddha are one and the same being. And you and the cosmic Buddha are one and the same being. For when you apprehend this place, you apprehend the cosmic Buddha. You apprehend Shakyamuni Buddha. You apprehend Marka Kishore. And you live with them and talk with them familiarly. But you only find this place if you have completely and absolutely accepted perceptual truth. That's the point at issue. Do not yearn for 2,000 years ago. At the present time, if you practice the truth, i.e. the turning of the wheel, and keep the precepts absolutely, Marka Kishore will not enter Mount Keisoku. He can come here and live in your Mount Keisoku with you. You do not have to be separate. You are never again alone. Therefore, the warm flesh of Shakyamuni is now and always here. And the smiling of Marka Kishore is now and always new. If you can find this spiritual place, you can accept the truth directly from Marka Kishore, and Marka Kishore will accept it back from you. Now, this is a very important thing. Do not think that you just accept something from the Master. The Master has to recognize it in you, and you have to give back. It is a giving, it is a flowing. Therefore, in this place, there is no such thing as a Master and Disciple. There is that which is beyond Master and Disciple. And yet, for eternity, there will always be a Buddha superior, senior to you, as long as you live. But in this place, there is no senior, no junior, just this exquisite oneness. There is no separation. Not only can the very truth pass through to you, i.e. the water of the Spirit, pass through to you from the seven Buddhas, but you were, are, and will be the ancestor of the seven Buddhas. For this which you have apprehended is before. It is the everlasting, the unborn, the undying, the uncreated. It is that which is before all things, the everlasting. So you are the ancestor of the seven Buddhas. You are just all living there together. The very truth is now here eternally, beyond all ages. Therefore, Shakyamuni Buddha accepted Marka Kishore's transmission and is now in heaven. You are now at the Ryozen meeting and unchangeable. Shakyamuni Buddha accepted the transmission of Marka Kishore. It was not a one-way transaction. It has to be shared. It is not something that can be held onto. Oh, wow, look what I found, and I am going to hold on to it. It is something which is when it is found that you want every single living being to enjoy. Because you want them to be in it with you. You do not want to exclude anything, ever. India, China, Japan, and the whole world must be included in the Ryozen meeting. The truth of the Lord comes to us unchanged. The water of the Spirit comes to us unchanged. Since this is so, this meeting, this very classroom, must be the Ryozen meeting, and the Ryozen meeting must be this one. Only when you concentrate your mind will you see Buddhas, i.e. will you apprehend or comprehend Buddhas. It's very difficult to find the right word. Will you be able to find this place and know Buddhahood? Only when you do it. Only when you meditate properly. Because of your ignorance about yourself, you believe that Shakyamuni Buddha died long ago and that you will die. In other words, there is birth and death because you are ignorant of your own true inheritance. You are the children of Buddha. Why do you kill the Buddha within yourself? Why do you turn your back on your rightful inheritance and fear and live in fear of life and death? Therefore, if you are in a hurry to find the truth, you can meet the Buddha any time you want. In daily life, Shakyamuni was, is, and will be walking, stopping, sitting, lying down, talking, and seeing by, in, and through, and with you, and is not separate from you even for a moment, being all of you. And if you don't see him throughout your entire life, it's because you're an undutiful being. And I would add, because you're stupid. Because only an idiot would turn that down. And it is very sad that so many people seem to do so. Now, you'll find, as you go through each chapter, that these chapters break down into these three sections, and they end with a small poem, which is the fourth section at the end. And the poems make one long poem, which you can watch a stream of thought running through, and you will see that this same stream of thought runs through every chapter of the Denkwa-Roku. The beauty of the ancestral line in the Denkwa-Roku, and one day I hope to have the whole of it translated, is quite simply this. You can find somebody with whom you can empathize absolutely in that line. Somewhere or other, there is going to be somebody who is exactly as good as or as bad as you ever were or are now, including the prize drunk, the prize sorcerer. But each one, no matter what he had that was wrong with him, had one thought in his mind. This is the best I know right now, but maybe there could be something better. In other words, his mind was not hard and set. The drunk thought there was nothing better than liquor. But when he found the patriarch and discovered that there was something better than liquor, he was never drunk again. There was no point to it. He'd found something so much better. The sorcerer was in the same situation. He thought playing sorcery was terrific, a terrific enjoyment, tremendous fun. Until one day he found that there was something even greater. And then he never did it again. So all of them had open minds, in one sense. And that type of open mind must be with people if they would truly change themselves. Now, I had hoped to have a fair amount of time to go through Lumps of the Denkwa-Roku with you, but I'm sure if you bump into any problems, you can bring them up as questions next time, because otherwise I will not get through the whole of this course. Ananda's problem, if you go to page 207, I know well that the real truth is not in the clever and erudite, nor is it in those who gain worldly rank. This is the proof. Ananda followed Marga Kishore for 20 years and was enlightened in the way described earlier. He was born on the same night as Shakyamuni Buddha was enlightened. He was always thinking that there must be something more than the Kesar of gold brocade. It couldn't be just that simple that one found this exquisite place within. There had to be something learned that one could pass on. He could not really believe it was that simple. And when he actually found it, he realized how much greater it was than learning. But if it hadn't been for him and his love of learning, we would not know nearly as much as we do about Shakyamuni Buddha. So do not despise old things that were of use earlier on. I can remember in the Far East when I got there being told learning was useless, and I'd been at British University and I'd been teaching for a good many years, and I said, fine, where can I dump all my books to burn them? And immediately the two people who told me learning was useless said, no, don't you do that. Don't think that you will be able to find the truth in those books. So I said, well, what's the use of lugging them about if they're no darn good? I mean, if I can't find the truth in them, what's the use of them? Oh, at a later date, you'll be able to find much use for them. You'll be able to use them to teach from, to show people how to get beyond them. And unless you keep showing people through words, they eventually never find that they have to get beyond words. In other words, you make people hungry with things for something through words and then teach them how to get beyond it. So it is very valuable. If Ananda had not written down what he did, no one would have known what the Buddha had said. If the secret of the golden flower had never been written, no one would have had this very nice little short 4-page explanation of how to do Zazen. If people hadn't written down how to sit with one's spine correctly, no one would have known the importance of the spine being correct. It would have become a very esoteric thing that was passed down throughout the centuries, and after a bit somebody would have got it wrong. So do not despise learning. Just do not think that that is the end of its purpose. One of the things you find as a result of doing proper meditation is that the human brain is a computer. When you live completely and absolutely from your center, the computer will provide that center with data that it can look at and decide which is the right thing to do. It is when the brain thinks that it is making the decisions that the trouble comes. When the brain is simply providing the information upon which the decisions are made, upon which the heart decides, it is a totally different matter. You will not fully understand that until you have had some experience in meditation. But it does make a very great difference. I'm going to leave that now because I need to get on with some work on the lotus blossom that hadn't finished off, and which will complete this. Page 243. Whenever you see the words, the teachings of consciousness and life, you should recognize that he is speaking here of body and mind, or body and Buddha nature. Now we are speaking here of figure 6. Outside the body, there is a body called the Buddha image. The thought which is powerful, the absence of thought is Buddhahood, i.e., in this place where there is no actual thinking and no deliberate attempt to think and no deliberate attempt not to think, in this place where one is still, in this place where one understands and recognizes the water of the spirit, this is the place of Buddhahood. The thousand-petaled lotus flower opens, transformed through breath energy. Because of the crystallization of the spirit, a hundredfold splendor shines forth. What a lot of people do not know about meditation is that in the early days, it can be quite dangerous to have visions, but it is normal and expected to have them once one has really learned how to meditate. It is at least expected that you will feel a certainty of them. You will feel, you will know, and understand, and frequently see. The reason why they are afraid of it in the early stages is, of course, very simple, because you might get fascinated. But what people do not realize is that in meditation stage 3, one actually sees the Buddha nature pass outside of the body. One sees it crystallize. One knows that it does genuinely exist. One knows that it is part of the cosmic Buddha. The certainty becomes so great that there is just no possible way that death and life can be anything more than two points in time, and that death and life just do not exist, because the only real life is that which exists that one has found within this meditation. Now, what is spoken of here, until you have done it for yourselves, you're going to have to take on faith. But don't believe it, because I'm telling you. Get out there, meditate, and do it for yourselves. As it says later on, not yet having arrived at the other shore, he cannot do without things. On arriving at the other shore, things can be used again. In the middle of the forehead, there is a constant point of white light. This is the third eye. And instead of doing it themselves, fools wait to ask a bodhisattva. In other words, everybody thinks, oh no, somebody else can do this, I'm the one that can't. But every single one of you in this room, if you truly want to, can do this for yourselves. You do not have to wait to get it from someone else. This is why I called this book, when I first published it, Selling Water by the River. Nobody believes they can do it, so I'm dishing up the water out of the river and saying, here, $5, please, for the book. But everybody can get this for themselves if they work at it. And here in the ancients, they're saying the fools are waiting to ask somebody else, when all they have to do is sit down and do it. But only you can do it for yourself. The first prince erects the pillar and sits in the mysterious city. The pillar, the spine, putting the spine correctly, erecting it correctly. The rest of this verse, three white cranes dance with eight mates. This is an old Chinese sign of joy. Anytime you see cranes and their mates, it's a congratulatory sign. It's a joyful thing. Wow, somebody's doing his meditation right, is what the line means. It's very simple. Changing pure breath, the word that's missing there, I think, is breath, causes the harmony of heaven and earth, i.e. the harmony of body and mind. Changing to pure breath, having got rid of all the old former karma. Eternal life causes this change in time. Passing the light outside, he houses the spirit within. In other words, being willing to die to old ways, being willing to die completely from what he had been as a result of the karma he carried around, he now becomes a human being in his own right. Having got rid of all the old karma, what is your purpose for living? Your purpose for living is now to be a totally different being. He passes the light outside. The lord of the house arrives quickly and joins the auspicious association. The true spirit enters. The certainty is certain. The peace is certain. Life becomes a totally different thing. With no mind in affairs, he has no affairs in mind. The sitting in meditation, neither thinking nor trying not to think. With no affairs in mind. Leaping out of the myriad illusions, there is not even one cloud. Every separate thought takes shape and becomes visible in color and form. The total spiritual power unfolds its traces and transforms itself into emptiness. This is a reference to seeing what is really happening when you are sitting still in this particular place. Instead of seeing all of you as what people normally think of as human beings, as live human beings, what is seen now is these are the shadows. This is the unreality. This is what will be born and will die. The reality is that which is within every one of you, and that is identically the same thing. So here the person is sitting in meditation. He sees every single thought. Each one of you is a separate thought, shall we say, taking color and form and transforming themselves into emptiness, appearing and disappearing, being born, dying. But this is not the real thing. Sitting still in this place, one knows what reality is. Going out into being and going into non-being, being born and dying, one completes the miraculous Tao. One completes the miraculous circle. One finds the lord of the house sitting still in this place without worrying about anything of this sort, just being still. It is when the true host is in possession rather than the guest of life. You have heard, I'm sure, of the host and guest theories. Some of you? Any of you? When the guest is in possession of the house is in trouble. When the host is in possession of the house is safe and looked after. When the cosmic Buddha is in possession of the body, all is well. When you think you're in possession of it, it's in trouble. In other words, when you are looking at this thing, not as the end of all things, but just as what it is, a transient thing that appears and disappears, and of which there is no real importance. All separate shapes appear as bodies, united with a true source. Now, this picture on opposite 247 is somewhat difficult to describe. It is supposed to show the man sitting inside himself, looking at all the different beings around him, seeing all the different beings around him, and recognizing that they're all just shadows. I am looking at 20-some shadows in here. Fairly substantial shadows, you will say. But the real you is what matters. And once you have had the wheel turn, as it speaks of in the Denkoroku, once you have had that wheel turn within you, you will know that this is a shadow. And you will know what reality is. And you will know a reality in a way that you have never known it before. But you can only take my word for it unless you've done it. So don't believe it, as I said, because I tell you. Believe it when you've proved it true for you. The shapes formed by the spirit fire are only empty colours and forms. This is just emptiness, remember. The light of human nature shines back on the primordial, the true. The spirit within you, the spark of the spirit within you, shines upon the remainder of the spirit, which is the whole of the universe, one recognizing the other. The imprint of the heart-mind, kokoro, the heart-mind, it's really the soul, cross between soul, heart, spirit, fragment of Buddha nature, any of those words you prefer. The imprint of the Buddha nature floats freely, untarnished. The boat of life has reached the shore, bright shines the sunlight. Until the boat of life reaches this shore, until the boat of life knows that this shore exists, we toss and turn on the sea of life, in terror and in fear. But when once this place is found, one sits safely on the shore, unafraid, certain. Without beginning, without end, without past, without future. A perfect description of how to sit in meditation. Without beginning, without end, without past, without future. An eternal now. Do not think that this is a negative thing. It is the most positive thing you can imagine. A halo of light surrounds the world of the law. Should be the wheel of the law. It surrounds the water of the spirit. We forget one another, quiet and pure, altogether powerful and empty. But it's the fullest emptiness you're ever going to bump into. And then he goes on to point that out. The emptiness is irradiated by the light of the heart, or by the light of the soul, and of heaven. The water of the sea is smooth and mirrors the moon in its surface. In addition to that, you are no longer on the sea, you are no longer tossed by it. You are safe in this place. The clouds disappear in blue space, the mountains shine clear. Consciousness reverts to contemplation. The moon disk rests alone. Consciousness reverts to contemplation. Sitting in meditation, looking at this exquisite place within, recognizing it in every other living being, and the exquisite joy that comes from that recognition. Because no longer are you arguing this one is this way or this one is that way. Now you are looking at something that is totally different and totally outside of what is normally regarded as understanding and cognition. You are looking at something which is true reality. And in that place, there can be no opposites, no worries as to caste or race or creed or sex or anything of the sort. In this place, every single thing, every single being stands as an individual and as a whole. The whole of the universe and each piece separate of the universe. Remember what it says in the scripture, combining them we can distinguish one from other, and yet these two are the same. The snowy heron in the bright moon hides, and yet you can distinguish them. And yet they are the same. I can look at the people at this table, you're all different, and yet you are the same. And to be able to look at all living things and know they are the same, no matter what they may appear as externally, is to be able to love all beings equally. And that is the main purpose of Buddhism, to be able to love all things equally, without saying, well, I like this one and I don't like that one, or you should see what sort of hats she wears, or something of this sort. No, do not look at that. Look at this exquisite place within. Find this exquisite place within. And don't worry two hoots about the externals. The human spine should look like that. And it represents the lotus blossom. And this is why a priest holds a lotus blossom. And you note that it looks at heaven. Now, each of these is a separate seed inside this. It feels like it's a piece of carved wood. And these are the seeds, or the droplets of the water of the Spirit. The seeds which, when they fall on others, help others to see their lotus blossom and to grow their lotus blossom. They can be the teaching of meditation. They can be assistance at a funeral or a wedding. But this is the representation of the spine. And when the priest holds it, one of the things that is very heavily bashed into you is, hold it up straight. Don't do this, don't do that. Otherwise, what are you teaching somebody? You're teaching them how not to sit. You're teaching them how to slump. This is a spine. And when you buy these, you are taking, to get your first one, usually by a very learned old monk who will carefully stand it like this and study it for a long time. This isn't quite straight. This will not do. And he will look at it from all angles to make sure that when this little finger, which you put underneath it, when you hold it, is there, it will stand absolutely straight. I could not understand when I was being trained why it was so important that you put a little finger underneath. It was because you were trying to teach people to stand straight or to sit straight when they meditate. And if you argue about it, well, then you don't mind if the spine wobbles. You are saying, I don't mind if I have a firm seat or not. I don't care whether I'm sincere or not. To stand up straight in the presence of the Buddhas and patriarchs. All these tiny little things in Zen that look like minuscule rules that are made to make life difficult are in actual fact to teach people the importance of doing it accurately, correctly, and of going the whole way and not holding anything back. So this is the first one. To the left hand which receives, to the right hand which gives out. The cord symbolizes that one is willing not only to receive, but to pass through and give out to others. So this is what is normally carried at a ceremony by a priest. There are all sorts of them. Some are very plain. They're merely shaped this way with a thing that goes over the top like that. Others are shaped like this, and they have a sort of dragon head going over the top. Another one will have an elephant head going over the top. The elephant, as I think I told you earlier, is the symbol of sainthood, and the dragon, the symbol of the defender of the faith. So according to how the priest feels, or according to the role in which he sees himself, so he chooses his nyoi. And sometimes they just have a straight piece of plain wood, which does just the same thing. That's the first thing I wanted to show you. Now this is a dorge. It represents the thunderbolt. At the time of a funeral, when a person has died or is just about to die, this is used in the right hand to represent the importance of the flow. Remember, things come in through the left hand and they go out via the right. This is the means of giving blessing. It's the means of safety, the dorge. Now, here it is. Throughout the book, there have been many stray symbols that it's difficult to understand. Nowadays, Buddhism, the Buddhist symbol you usually see, which it corresponds to the Christian equivalent of the cross, is an om symbol, which looks like a three with an extra piece on it. But you should know that that is a Hindu symbol. It is not really Buddhist. The reason is that Hitler, during his lifetime, chose the Buddhist symbol, unfortunately, which also happened to be the same as a fertility symbol in Germany. He chose it as the fertility symbol. I don't think he chose it because it was the Buddhist one, because he was teaching anything but Buddhism. Anyway, he chose our symbol and has got it into something like disrepute. So nowadays Buddhists are using the Om symbol. But it should be known that the rightful symbol of a Buddhist is actually a swastika. But it is not a swastika that goes in the direction that Hitler put his. His one goes anti-clockwise, which is the symbol for cruelty. The Buddhist one goes clockwise, which is the symbol towards compassion. And on the big certificates that are given to priests when they become priests, there are two swastikas, one going one way and one going the other. And it symbolizes that one has turned away from evil and is willing only to turn towards compassion and good. It is interesting that he would choose the one that was going towards evil, because he certainly went along with it. But perhaps one day in the near future, who knows, we will be able to return to our rightful symbol, which is the right-turning manji. However, this, for those who still feel that they can't daren't use a manji or a swastika, is the best equivalent one can come up with. Now, this represents the human body. Here you have the genital area. Then you have this, which is the sort of cosmic washing machine, which is the intestines. Then you have the two fish, which represent the lungs, the stone in the center, which represents the cockerel. Then you have the conch shell, which is the voice, or in here, which sounds like the voice of the cosmic Buddha when you use it correctly. And then you have the flame rising to the top of the head, which is the spirit rising above the head. This is a bit complicated, but I personally would prefer, if I was going to use something other than a swastika, to use this rather than an om, because an om is muddling the situation somewhat. I'll leave this on the table for anyone who wants to look at it later. Now, I want to show you this scroll. I have been painting this scroll, trying to get it done before this course was over. I have not succeeded, but I have done a fair bit of it.
You remember, I explained that the pictures in the book represented several cycles. Now, I also said that you always started roughly at the beginning of each cycle. You don't start right back at the beginning. I hope I didn't mislead anybody in that. You start here when you can no longer make any sense of what's going on in life, when wealth and knowledge and the like no longer make any sense to you, is when you stop going along these roads and you start going up the mountains, through the darkness, through what is popularly called the dark night of the soul. And those of you who've got copies of St. John of the Cross will recognize, and I didn't realize it when I painted this, a tremendous similarity as to how to start this particular journey. Now, having turned one's back on hell, One must also turn one's back on heaven and go on, if one would. But the tragedy is that too many people, after a first cycle, and this represents a first Kensho, are far too satisfied just sitting on the shore here, looking at this beautiful moon's reflection. But remember, it's only a reflection. Who will be satisfied with a reflection when he can have the moon? Who will be satisfied with the moon, which only has a reflection of the sun, when he can have the sun? Who will be satisfied with the sun when he can, in fact, have that which created the sun? So what you are doing, each time you do one of these cycles, you are effectively saying, I'm not going to be contented with this. I know this is only the tip of the iceberg. I know I can go much further. So having done the first journey, one then goes to the next one. Right. Now, one has to go back to a certain extent. You see, here it was very dark and very forbidding. Now, this beautiful lake, which has become quietistic, has become very arid, and one starts going through the aridity. In the first place, one had to clean up one's own life, and this represents the cleaning up of one's own life, dealing with all the things that one has done, getting, making friends with all those you've turned into enemies, sorting out anything that was done wrong, that was illegal, getting all this dealt with, so that one had the right to die. But that was only for what one had done in one's own particular lifetime. In order to get to the next one, you have now got to start sorting out with what was done in previous lifetimes. So you go through the aridity to get to this set of past lives and go on up through all the horrors to get to the next one. But you see, although you have the... you've got to this exquisite stage when you're no longer just looking at the thing from the shore of the lake. Although you are now actually sitting in the lake, you are actually already budding. It's still night time. You've got rid of an awful lot of past karma, you've got rid of an awful lot of smell out of the bag, but you're still not there. You've only just had a second one. So what you have to do is go back again and find out what else has to be cleaned up. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to get any further than that. But do you see what I'm saying? The thing is cyclic. You keep having to go back a certain amount, but you never go back the whole way. All right, I've got any questions? This one's tying up knots from last week and the week before. Yeah?
I have a question from last time.
Yeah.
You said, I think you said it anyway, the prayer of Jesus is close to what goes on in Sazen.
Yes.
Could you explain that?
The prayer of Jesus, correctly used, as I understand it, comes out as a mantra.
Yeah, okay.
And when one stops using it as a mantra, and it becomes sort of part of oneself, one is just sitting there with the prayer of Jesus almost as part of one's blood and bones, one is actually in Zazen.
Like it's percolating all the time?
Not necessarily percolating, it's just become so much a part of you, you've used it as the key with which to unlock a door. You no longer need a key once the door's undone.
It's like the way in which counting the breaths leads to following the breath leads to just being aware of just simply.
By the way, I have got here part of what I wanted to do for this lecture, which we're not going to get time to do. Remember I told you there was some notes I had on the adversary and how it became almost a two-god system, a God the Father and God the Devil last time? These are the notes which actually give you the places as to where to find all these bits in the Bible. It would cost about 25 cents each if we got these Xerox. Anybody? Yes?
Yeah,
Yes, go ahead.
In reading the Wild White Goose, I came across something that gave me a question, and that was, after you had your first kensho, mm-hmm. why did you have to attend sesshin and still receive beatings? You know, what purpose did that fill?
Well, if you do not keep your meditation up, especially after just the first one, as Yasodhani Roshi puts it, all that will be left is a beautiful memory. You have to always do your meditation. Now, Shakyamuni Buddha always carried his begging bowl, always wore his robes, and always did his meditation. It is necessary to keep it going, always. I am not God. There is nothing in me that is not of God. And I want to stay in that situation permanently. As to why did I get beaten up? I suppose somebody felt like doing it. That's the only answer I can give you to the second half. Yes.
Do you think, or would you explain what you think it means in the Bible that you can't have God and mammon too?
God and mammon too. You cannot serve two masters.
Yes,
that's definitely for sure. One of the things you really cannot do once you have truly meditated is that you cannot live by the old ways you used to in order to earn a living. You have to absolutely be sure that it is a right way of living that you are living after that.
You mean that you're not exploiting people?
There is a whole bunch of things in the ancient Buddhist teachings, not killing, not by flesh, trading in living beings. You can't be a butcher, you can't be a slave owner, you can't be, can you remember any of the others? They're so obvious that I can never remember them. Can you remember them? I know you mustn't buy and sell animals. You mustn't be a butcher. You mustn't buy and sell humans. You mustn't do anything that exploits another person. You may not charge usury, that's right. You can't charge profit. You mustn't make a profit. Yes! In other words, you can't do anything that breaks the precepts. Earn a living, but you may not profiteer. There's a difference. I had a psychiatrist ask me this question once. And he said, well, how can I be a psychiatrist and do this? And I said, well, can you eat $60 an hour if you work eight hours a day? And he said, no. I said, all right, how much does it cost to keep up the office, to pay your secretary, to feed you and your wife and your children and educate the kids better than you were educated? Anything beyond that is profiteering. In other words, anything beyond what is absolutely necessary.
No windfall profits.
No windfall profits, right. What the oil companies would appear to be doing is wrong livelihood.
It seemed to me that mammon was materialism to make possessions and or learning or whatever mm-hmm. to be your master rather than God.
Well, that's exactly what that comes out as. Yes.
Then you really can't seek and enjoy or just immerse yourself in so-called worldly things and have God too, can you?
No way. And there is also another thing. This has come up a number of times. Is Buddhism selfish because it says because of the laws of karma? Well, it's somebody's karma, so that's what happens to them. Yes, what is happening to the boat people, for example, is their karma. It is also going to be our karma if we don't give them some help. Now, it's quietism when you sit back and say, but that's their karma, it does not touch me, I will go off and do my meditation. Because that's not meditation, that's selfishness. It's complete quietism. And it is also quietism if you do nothing but go off and help them and don't realize that you are just a do-gooder.
You mean if you're just doing that without meditation?
Without meditation and without recognizing, yes, it is their karma. It's their karma to be in that situation. Yes,
could you explain the middle way of living?
The middle way of living?
Or treading the... Is that part of the...
That's exactly what we've been talking about. Not being a beggar, not being a profiteer. Not trying to interfere with other people, not thinking that what happens to them is not your problem. You have got to help them and not interfere with them. You have got to live without being a profiteer. You have got to look after your children and love and punish them when they need it. One has to live in the middle path at all times. In all things, in all ways.
That's between the two opposites.
Between the two opposites. And when you truly live between those two opposites, you are actually living in this place within one's own center.
So would you be meditating if you were always living in the middle, between the two opposites, so to speak?
If you would stay in that place all the time, you would have to. There's no other way you could do it.
One comment about that is that in order to truly find the middle way, you have to do it by finding the place within, and then the middle way manifests. You can't sort of skate around the opposites to find the place within.
That's what I mean. That's the ideal, I presume, to be in the middle way.
It's actually a lot easier once you find it than you think.
Yeah, you have to find it within
yourself. Once you've found it, it's a lot easier to live on in that middle place than one would realize. The real difficulty is that so many people don't understand it, and they get very worried by you being there, and they try very hard to pull you out of it.
Do you get that middle place by intuition, or because you don't think about it, of course? If you think about it, you're...
Well, all I can say is you always know when you're not there. But you never completely... Well, yes, do you know when you're there? There are confirmatory signs, yes. That's the best way to put it. But you always know when you're not there.
Also, the more meditation you do, the less you can make those unreal choices about things.
Yes. There is also another thing. When you live from that place, there is no wake left behind in what happens in daily life. The catastrophes seem to be a lot less.
Well, then would it be a place where there's really no joy or no despair, so to speak?
It's a place where there is no despair and no joy, as most people understand the term joy. There is joy, it's exquisite. But it's not as people understand the term joy as an opposite of despair.
There is no opposite, actually.
Yes, it's beyond that situation. It's a very, very exquisite place to live.
Most people go through emotional swings. Which is pleasant today, leads to that which is joy.
Yes, it's emotional joy as opposed to the real thing.
Yeah.
Or emotional good and evil as opposed to the real thing.
And it's beyond emotions.
Yes, beyond emotionalism.
Yeah.
Not beyond emotions. One still has emotions, but one does not become emotional. Shakyamuni Buddha himself said that no child or son or daughter was to be allowed to enter the order unless the parents were safe, because they may be the only means of keeping the parents alive. One of the most beautiful rules of the order. You may not take a child, a son or daughter, from a parent who needs that parent. who needs that son or daughter. And that came out of a direct action that happened during the Buddha's own lifetime. A 7-year-old boy was brought to the Buddha and he immediately made him a monk. And the parents came and said, what are we going to do in our old age? Now there's no one who will be able to keep us and look after us. And it is said that the Buddha wept great tears, for he realized what great wrong he had done. And one of the most solemn rules that is kept by every branch, in every country of the Buddhist church, because he so strongly spoke about it, is this one about not ordaining anyone unless their parents are willing. So that's another thing that stops Buddhism being a cult in this country. You can't take somebody's son or daughter and just ordain them and not allow them to see their parents. That would be automatically to stop it being Buddhist. That would kill it immediately. So if you know of any organization calling itself Buddhist that's doing that, it ain't Buddhist.
Is there an age limit for a person becoming a monk or a...
No. Yes.
I think that brings up the question about both saying yes and no equally. And what is behind it is not the action in itself, but the giving and the not giving.
Yes.
You know, if there's the compassion, that's what I meant in the question about non-interfering sometimes in certain instances is the truest and greatest amount of love we can give to someone. Yeah.
To give them space to do whatever it is they're doing, because it's the only way they're going to learn.
And in funny ways, with that problem, which I've come up a number of times, and trying to feel the appropriateness of each time, and many times it's just I'm supporting someone's self-imposed inadequacy that they refuse. And
yes.
especially very young people just out on the streets.
Yeah. Beauty of this thing is when you find this place, there is no inadequacy. Because there is only inadequacy in opposites. There is not inadequacy when one reaches the place that is beyond them. We will do what we can. Yes, go ahead.
Once I was forced to beg myself, I learned an awful lot about spare changers from that experience, because it took me an hour to get 60 cents. For a bus ride across the bay when my wallet was locked in the office. No one stopped to ask me why in the world I was asking for dimes, except one person who looked poorer than myself. And he said, I've been in the same place, man, and I want to help you get home. It was, you know, I had to catch the last bus at 2 in the morning. And then I learned that Americans have this horrible fear that you're going to encourage this condition, and they just... want to stay 10 feet from you. And so since that experience, I've just taken to asking people why they want money from me. And I've had some amazing answers.
Yeah.
And I give it to them if I like the, you know, if I agree with what they're asking.
I got stuck in that position once. This was in England many years ago. And I was a professional musician at the time, and I was dressed up like a dog's dinner, you know what I mean? I'd just finished playing. And here I am, 40 miles from home, because I got in the wrong half of the train. Never mind why, that's another tale. But I got in the wrong half of the train. And I hadn't got a brass cent to get home. You know, there was a play, it was 2 in the morning, because the concert didn't end till something like 11. And there was a policeman on the station who sort of looked at me, and if I had been him and looked at me, I would have wondered what my occupation was. With a certain amount of reason. And I told him the honest truth, what had happened. And he said, oh, come on down to the station, I'm the local sergeant. He sat me down and he gave me coffee, it was cold. And he called up a taxi service and he lent £5, which was a heck of a lot of money in those days, for the taxi fare to get me home. I said, look, I have got no means of paying you back until probably next Tuesday, because it was one of these wretched weekends, you know, when it was a long weekend and the banks weren't open on Monday, but that's all right. And the taxi driver sort of looked at me, oh, you're a fool, lending the cash and all the rest of it. But But I sent him the money back. I got a charming letter from him. He gave me an opinion of the police that I'd never had before. And it's also meant that I've always cooperated with him since, so he did rather well. In my... But it's an interesting little story as to why and how people do get stuck. Mm-hmm. Like your one.
Gandhi said, don't give alms to an able-bodied man. And I kind of keep that in mind.
Who said that?
Gandhi.
Yeah. Well, again, as you said, you've got to know the reason why he needs
right.
it. Because you were an able-bodied man who was trying to get home.
Right,
and
right.
I was a very able-bodied female in more ways than one who was trying to get home.
But I was disabled in a sense. If anyone would have asked, I would have been happy to explain. You know?
Yeah.
And I was going to mail back their 10 senses if they wanted. But nobody
well,
did.
I did. But that's the nearest I ever got in. And it's a miserable situation to be in. Yes.
More on the topic of right livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
You were saying before that if everyone got there and acted accordingly, yeah. we wouldn't need welfare. And,
yes, what I talked about last lecture. Yes.
But since we're not there, since we do have a welfare state, is there anything inherently wrong in working with it?
In working with it?
Within it?
No. Because we work within it and through it, and eventually out of it. The system that was prevalent as the finest system of civilization, shall we say, 2,000 years ago, was what was in Rome, and nobody would regard that as a good system of civilization nowadays. There would have been far too much wrong with it. There were slaves, there was no social services, there was the extremely rich and everybody else nobody worried about. And people worked through that, and gradually throughout the centuries, people have worked through having public hangings and public executions to disliking them. And gradually we've got to the state when every child is entitled to an education, and to every person eventually will be entitled to the right of health care. And maybe one day we'll get to the state when every person is entitled to spiritual care, too. Which would be rather nice. No, I see nothing wrong with working in it. So long as you don't think this is the end of the line. The danger is if you think this...
No.
We've got the most perfect system we don't have to do anymore.
Well, there's very little.
Well, the Romans definitely thought they got the finest system in existence. And at the time, they had.
Maybe the politicians have to do it. The Roman slaves probably didn't agree.
Quite. But you see what I'm getting at? You have to work with it. You can't discard it. I just don't think this is the end of the line. Is anybody else? Well, this is a very difficult lecture today, because it's talking of something that very few people have experienced. Or I suspect far more have actually experienced it than are willing to talk about it. In ancient times, all of this was encoded because it was dangerous in such countries as China and Korea to even discuss the possibility of something greater than the emperor, or something in which you and the emperor shared. And nowadays, as I was saying only a few days ago on the radio, to another radio program, we are in a country where we can speak freely and where we don't have to worry about whether we're going to upset the president by saying that there is something superior to him. So we can actually talk of these things openly, and we can experience them. And that is one of the beauties of being here, and also one of the reasons why I'm talking. I'm not afraid to talk. So if anybody else has got anything, if they haven't, we'll... Yes?
The Chardin's The Future of Man, or Phenomenon of Man. Are you familiar with that? He's a Catholic, but what he is, I think, saying is that the ultimate goal of humanity would be to go back into God, in other words, have kinship and go with
yes.
God. And it will come one day when...
Oh, it definitely will. There is no doubt we are moving towards it. admittedly with the speed of an unenergetic snail, but we are going. We are not completely standing still. It's taking us an awfully long time. But look how far we've got. Yes. And just to, in the last 100 years, look what has happened to black people in this country. Look what has happened to education. Look at the welfare systems. Things do change. Not very fast, but they go.
And this other book, Cosmic Consciousness, Dr. Brooks says that there'll be more Ken shows as, you know.
Well, the thing is that as fast as one person has one, it seems to fire down other people. It seems to cause others to have them.
That it'll be more common as
yes, it becomes much more common. I can remember in Sorgiji when I was there that every session, if one or two people got them, it would seem to fire down everybody in the row of trainees, because it was sort of catching. It was a nice sort of thing to catch. It's really fascinating to watch it happen. So let's do some meditating now. That livelihood for monk is very difficult, for example, in this country where begging is not the normal thing, and begging is the normal in a Buddhist country. And the only way we could handle it was by trying to find out what was the spirit behind going begging. And it was so that you should not have more than you absolutely needed. That's one of the reasons I only do one set of courses a year, for which I get paid. This one. I can live quite happily with what this one provides. And that is, this is my begging bowl that you're attending. You're all sitting in it. But it's the only way I can do it and keep the law of the land, because Buddhism also says you must keep the law of the land in which you live. Buddhism is not an anarchistic religion. Yeah, go ahead.
It seems to me that as you do the practice, it becomes more and more possible to see right livelihood within the job that you happen to have, unless it is, you know, one that's grossly such as the kind that you mentioned, but within the systems and with all of that, it seems to me there are many, many opportunities throughout the
yes.
day.
Yes, yes. And if you're doing the job honestly because you want to do something right and good, then it can very soon appear, its right livelihood aspect can very soon appear. But if you're doing it solely because you want to earn a living, or because it happens to be the only job that's available or something of that sort, then you're in trouble. Yes?
Does right livelihood allow a little something put away for a rainy day?
a monk in the Far East is allowed to have 7 things, one of which, interestingly enough, is a water filter. And I have this interesting gadget which cost me $15, which I carry with me everywhere. And considering the state of Oakland's water, it's a very good idea. And you're allowed these 7 things. And you are also allowed enough. You're supposed to have enough valuables to cover the cost of your funeral.
Not exactly.
Yeah. Yes, you're allowed enough to cover the cost of a funeral. And it's supposed to be in the things you've got, and your manji and your rosaries and the value of your robes and things like that. Yes?
Well, I think it must also be, you must be able to sort of include being able to take care of yourself in your old age so that you're not dependent upon.
Well, the Buddhist priesthood has always taken care of old people in the priesthood. They are never allowed to become a charge on the state. While the duties of the younger priest is to make sure the older ones don't become a charge on the state.
If you're not a priest, I presume that means that you can get a pension or save up.
In the Far East, any time somebody got to old age, he or she would automatically go along to the monastery and live there. Become a monk in his or her old age. That doesn't happen in Japan, but it certainly happens in Burma and Thailand and the other countries. But yes, you could most certainly take out a pension. I see nothing wrong. There's nothing incompatible with the Buddha's teachings on that. Yes?
I'm not too clear on this, what you just said about past lives, somebody being on their 10th one. Does it follow from that if you do whatever you're supposed to do with one, then no more come up? Or?
They only come up to show you what you shouldn't have done. If you realize what it was you shouldn't have done after the first one and don't do it again, no more are going to turn up. What's the point in constantly dreaming the same dream if you've cottoned on to what the dream is telling you?
Not to confuse that with the fact that if you learn the lesson of whatever it is that's coming up, you may have something else come up associated with some other lesson, and there may be a number of them that come up, but you don't keep getting the same basic storyline over and over again.
Yeah. Go ahead, what were you saying? Go on.
I don't
want to
say anything.
Okay.
I'm just going to sit here and absorb it all.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a great one for lists. What are the seven things?
One razor, three robes, that gives you four, water purifier, one bag to carry them all in, and one staff. You are also, in the old rules, allowed... there's one lovely part of this. You are allowed two good pairs of sandals or an unsophisticated means of transport if you're too old to walk. And an unsophisticated means of transport in the East means a second-hand car, provided you're willing to share it with other people, or a motorbike. And in Japan, they even have a special helmet for motorbike riders, which is the official helmet of the monks. And you go along and you buy your motorcycle helmet from the Karamoya's catalogue. Include the unsophisticated means of transport, which is rather neat. That's why we get big old cars and put extra seat belts in them. And there was a very, very compassionate program, again on that long search thing last night on Channel 60, on the state of the long search in California. And the person who was doing it was a very, very compassionate man, because he said, I know everybody snickers about all the different religions that are in California and how stupid Californians are to have all these things. It's all very well to scoff at the fact that they are doing it by these, some seemingly to us, silly means. But don't scoff at the need, because we've all got the same need. They just happen to have got a climate in which they can indulge it, which is a very good point. We've got the climate in which we can conduct the hunt. And he gave another couple of very valuable pieces of information. He cleared up something that I've been trying to clear up for years, and I'm glad to hear it on TV. And that is that the word guru, a guru, is anything whatsoever in which you can see a higher reflection of yourself. So your guru for this minute may be a beautiful tree, or a dog, or a cat, or your mother, or your father, or a table. Anything in which you can see a higher reflection of you, and which teaches you. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that when we were talking about joy a while back, that most experiences of joy for human beings are some kind of connectedness.
Yeah.
Being connected with another human being. Or feeling
the snowy heron in the bright moon hides. Combining them, we can distinguish and see the similarity. Yes.
So a lot of people search for that in wrong ways.
Like, well, how do we know they're wrong ways?
Not I know ways what. That you teach.
Yes. I don't regard anybody's way as wrong unless it does. There are certain things that it has to do for me for it to be a way that's safe to go. First of all, does it teach that there is something higher and greater than what we see around us? Secondly, does it teach perceptual truth? Thirdly, does it benefit the rest of mankind?